Hello and welcome to the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, journalists, scholars, filmmakers, musicians, and collectors. Anything to do with pop culture and the national pastime. Our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Now with birds. Circumstances unfortunately have forced me to relocate where I record a portion of these conversations, at least for the time being. So now I'm in proximity of three of our birds, and they love to chime in from time to time, especially if they think they're not having attention paid. So if you hear some odd sounds like that from time to time, you'll know why. That said, on with the show. In recent days, I've noticed that a number of new baseball titles have updated nostalgia. By that, I mean the subject of these books are more recent than they used to be. Case in point, Scott Turbo's new book, Dynastic Bombastic Fantastic, Reggie, Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's. When did the 1970s become the new 1950s? So it's with a sense of relief that I read Paul Dixon's latest biography, Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. Dixon's contribution to baseball literature is immeasurable. Among his work, Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, which is the recipient of numerous awards, the Baseball Dictionary, the Baseball Dictionary, now in its third edition, The Joys of Keeping Score, and Baseball's Greatest Quotations. He's also been honored with the Baseball Reliquary's Tony Salen Award, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, for his work in preserving baseball history, as well as Sabre's Henry Chadwick Award, and I know I'm pronouncing that right, which honors baseball researchers for their invaluable contributions to making baseball the game that links America's present with its past. I spoke with Dixon recently about the Durocher legacy and why he chose to take on this topic. Paul Dixon, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you, Ron. A pleasure to be here.
For our younger listeners who may not be familiar with Leo Durocher, could you tell us a little bit about him and why you wanted to do this book?
Well, Durocher was probably one of the most controversial, sometimes profoundly disliked, sometimes widely admired characters in baseball history. He was a player. He played, his first game was for the New York Yankees, 1925. His last game was for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1945. So he played as a player. But during that period, beginning in 1939, he became one of the great managers of all time, first with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and reaching his pinnacle with the New York Giants. And, of course, the 1951 miracle, Bobby Thompson home run, that was all under his tutelage. He also plays a very large role in the integration of baseball. He's the manager who brings up Jackie Robinson, gets him through those couple of spring trainings, one in the Dominican. He's also the one that really brings Willie Mays into the forefront and really, really manages him well. And with him racially integrates the New York Giants with Henry Thompson, Monty Irvin, and Willie Mays, who become three of the most outstanding players he'll ever deal with. Ran into some trouble with the Cubs there for, ended up with the Houston Astros. So he goes through a huge period of baseball history. He starts in New York during Prohibition and ends up with these, you know, landing on the moon Houston Astros. He goes from the early writers all the way up to Jimmy Breslin and the later sports writers of the late 20th century. Oh, Breslin was more than a sports writer. But he had a vast impact on New York and the culture of New York when the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers were the fiercest of competitors, and within the two boroughs separated by a river and a bridge, were had at it all the time. And of course, at one crucial moment, when anybody our age or older remembers or grew up with, was the overnight change from being a manager, fiery, controversial manager of the Dodgers, and then going across to the Giants overnight and picking up the Giants.
Now you mentioned his lengthy career. It spans about 50 years or so. So he must have seen, you mentioned he starts in Prohibition and ends with Man on the Moon. He must have seen a tremendous amount of changes in the game. And I was thinking, as I'm reading your book, and now I'm reading Marty Appel's biography of Casey Stengel, who also had an extremely long career, I'm wondering which decades or which epochs provided the biggest changes in the game. Now, you could talk about integration, you could talk about night baseball, you could talk about expansions. I'm just wondering from your point of view, which era offered the most dramatic changes in the game as we know it?
If you take the perspective of what I wrote about as opposed to my own personal, you know, thinking, I think for DeRocher it came, first of all, I think it really came towards the end when he was the one, it was the players' union, it was the rising stars, the new players, the players that didn't sit back and always just take his guff. He could be very, very rough on players. I think he didn't understand the modern players. When he gets to the Cubs, he ends up at total odds with Ernie Banks and Ron Santo, who are two of the most likable guys in the history. He actually has a playhouse revolt at the Cubs in 1970. He's that aggressively anti-union, anti-players with a voice of their own. And during his career, he picks the greatest fights with the most powerful people. I mean, the people he really dislikes are Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, and drives him crazy, John Wayne. I'll get to that in a minute. Right on through to, right to the end. He had these hang-ups where he couldn't get away from it. I think when the players' union started, the great irony was the real players' pension fund was created by Happy Chandler, who had actually banned him from baseball at one point. And he was he was getting the largest amount of money in his later years. He was living on his money from the players, but he was fighting that same thing. I think he couldn't stand the change.
Now, you mentioned John Wayne. Talk a bit about DeRocher's career away from the field. It seemed he had aspirations for the stage and screen. And I'm wondering, I mean, he certainly had the ego, but I'm wondering if he had the talent.
He did. He had, he's very, very, very poorly educated in the fact that he never went to high school. And that. He had a gift. He had an ability to talk to people. One of his friends once said that he could go into a meeting, a party with all atomic scientists, all nuclear physicists, and have them spellbound by some random fact that he picked up in the washroom on the way in. That he had this ability, and he befriends early on. He becomes great friends with with Frank Sinatra in the 40s during a war bond drive. He then became great friends with Danny Kaye. He marries Lorraine Day, who was a great heartthrob of that era. You know, he was almost every teenage boy's dream. She played against John Wayne in a lot of movies. But he had one part of his life that was all people like Spencer Tracy. I mean, mine may be the only baseball book you'll ever read where Greta Garbo, Judy Garland, Mr. Ed the Talking Horse, and the Munsters are in the index.
Uh-huh. I remember very well those two episodes of Mr. Ed and the Munsters.
But he goes at one point when he leaves the Giants, he gets a contract with NBC for $75,000 as a talent. And he not only just sort of game of the week kinds of things, but they actually use him at one point to host the Colgate Comedy Hour, which ran against the famous Ed Sullivan Show, which was a great show of its era. But he hung out with all the comedians and Jeff Chandler was his buddy, and he played golf with all these famous people. Sinatra stood with him all his life. He was also a member of the Rat Pack. He's very close to Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin. He would talk when he was with the Cubs. He talked to Dean Martin from the dugout. He'd get on the phone with Dean Martin or Sinatra.
So what was his beef with John Wayne?
Oh, John Wayne, when he married Lorraine Day, the great movie actress, She was making a movie called Tycoon at that point with John Wayne. She appeared against John Wayne or opposite John Wayne in a lot of movies. And DeRocher got so furious, he would go down to the set every day and make faces at John Wayne when he was in the love scenes with Lorraine Day. And he'd make noises, and he'd get all grumbly because Wayne would be kissing her. And they had to shut down the set and ban him from the studio. John Wayne said later, he said he intimidated me. You know, he said the reason that movie, the love scenes, which in those days were kissing and hugging, the love scenes were terrible because DeRocher was so angry with me for kissing his wife.
you mentioned the movie 42, and you mentioned the portrayal of DeRocher. First of all, what did you think of that movie in general? And what did you think of Christopher Maloney's portrayal of DeRocher in particular?
I think in both counts, I give it a five. There were small little factual errors in it, which you and I know about, but I think in general it was the most potentially wonderful educational device for people who didn't live through or didn't know about that era. I think the portrayal of DeRocher was right on. I'd have a footnote in my book that the only thing they got wrong in that scene was the color of the bathrobe.
Because that seemed like, from all the other things I've read, and certainly from your book, the scene where DeRocher confronts the players in the kitchen of the hotel where they're staying during spring training in Cuba is very accurate as far as even the dialogue goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And where he tells the players, they have he knows there's a petition being circulated. He tells them what sanitary purpose they can use the petition with. There was the follow-up. You didn't have time in the movie. But the follow-up to that night was, the next couple days, he's still got guys who are virulently opposed to Robinson's joining the team. So what he would do is, Lorraine Day would leave the stadium. They'd be playing an exhibition game in Cuba. She would leave the stadium, and he would leave the stadium. And the papers saw, uh-oh, during the game. They say, uh-oh, they're going to have a little extramarital or an extra marital, you know, moment at the hotel, and they're going back early for a little lovemaking and stuff. But what Lorraine Day reveals much later in her own biography was that it was a ruse, because DeRocher was going back to the hotel with one of the players and literally browbeating them, literally saying, look, you guys got to do this. This has to be true. This has to be done, and you're the ones who are not going to, you're the ones who are going to suffer, not, you know, more than anything else, if this doesn't go through. And ironically, the other part of the speech, which was not actually used in the movie, but he says, look at boys, he said, these guys are coming, and they're coming in large numbers, and they're going to beat you out, and a lot of them are as good as you are, but a lot of them are better than you are. So hang on to your seats, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where he went on that night. And again, what everybody who heard him in these critical moments was, when he could control his temper, which was not all the time, he was magnificently articulate. He would speak in complete sentences that were devoid of extra adjectives. It was like a scriptwriter was following him. Yet he was not a highly tutored guy. I think he learned a lot about comedy and the ability to express himself during World War II, when he would go on these USO tours with Danny Kaye and other comedians, and I think they taught him a lot about timing.
Now, what about the business of, you mentioned DeRocher's relationship with Robinson early on and his relationship with the black players on the Giants. DeRocher was suspended for Robinson's rookie year. One of the reasons he seemed to get in the movie is because of his relationship with Lorraine Day at that time. But is that the sole reason for his suspension?
Well, it's always been, it's so complicated because there were a whole lot of reasons. One was, the movie was accurate to a point because they also have the Roman Catholic priest calling in to wanting to get him out of there. He was also very much involved. He and the team were very much involved with gamblers, and these were guys who were. There was one guy was Connie Immerman was famous because he was a big time bootlegger and bookie, ran a nightclub in Harlem, and then another guy named Memphis Engelberger. These sounds like names made up by Damon Runyon. But so those guys were hanging around the clubhouse.
Excuse me, I just wanted to clarify. When you say involved, there was no gambling going on as far as baseball was concerned.
Well, they were gambling in the clubhouse, and when Branch Rickey comes in, he tells, as the general manager comes from the Cardinals to the Dodgers, before he'll renew DeRocher's contract, he said, get the gamblers out of the clubhouse. The guys were betting during games. There were high-stakes poker games going on in the clubhouse.
But they weren't betting on baseball games.
No, but they were betting on, a pitcher would come in and lay down $40 with the bookies were literally in the dugout. Mm-hmm. They'd lay down $40 on a race at Hialeah or one of the afternoon, because they were playing afternoon ball. So they were betting during the game and everything else. So the argument was that he was hanging out with these gangsters. He'd been hanging out with them since there. Not gangsters. You think, when I say gangsters, these guys weren't Murder Incorporated. They were bookies and bootleggers. They were victimless in its crimes in the sense of the modern sense of the mob and such. But they were still guys operating outside the law. And he had a lot of association with that. But this is the ultimate thing in the suspension, which is a lot of people, there was one hearing in which he was, the Happy Chandler held, and Rickey was there and other people from the Dodgers. And at one point in the meeting, he goes into his pocket, Chandler goes into his pocket and whips out this letter, and he said, there's pressure from Washington to get DeRocher out of baseball. And he waves the letter at Rickey and the other Dodgers officials who were there, and then puts the letter back in his pocket. And just that's the end of it. But everybody's trying to figure out who this letter from Washington is. Is it J. Edgar Hoover? Could it be the president? Who is it? Who's sent this letter? It's not until decades later, that before he dies, that Chandler reveals that it's really Frank Murphy, who is a Supreme Court justice, very devout Catholic, who had been taking a lot of his cues from the Catholic diocese, which was Brooklyn and such, the CYO, these other Roman Catholic organizations, which saw DeRocher as a divorced Catholic. He's already divorced. DeRocher himself was Catholic, and that they saw him as a bad influence and were threatening to boycott Dodgers games. So it's a whole stew of reasons. But the Frank Murphy thing seems to be, and very few people have ever written about it. Actually, there's a copy of the letter in the Murphy's archives at the University of Michigan. But it was Murphy who was very, very close to Branch Rickey in terms of their own morality, their own friendship, their what they believed in. They were both very liberal, but that was their take.
You also mentioned in the book that although DeRocher was a big supporter of Robinson early on, that changed very quickly, it seems. But it has nothing to do with any racial animosity. It's just that DeRocher always wanted to win, and he thought that Robinson was playing with those chances of winning.
Yeah, and I think also, I think I got one of the last interviews with Monty Irvin before he passed away. And Irvin said, I asked him about that, because he was close to both guys, in fact, very close to both guys. And he said, it had nothing to do with race. It was two very competitive guys who had lived totally different lifestyles. And so when DeRocher comes back to the Dodgers after the suspension, the beginning of the 48 season, Robinson has put on some weight. He's been on the banquet circuit all winter. He's been wined and dined. And he's put on a couple pounds. And DeRocher's furious with him. And Card's calling him fatso, starts going to the press with it. He stayed skinny for 47. He got fat for me. Really started. And Robinson almost immediately realized how much he disliked him. He saw him as a cologne-soaked bully, I think was one of the phrases that was used. But he didn't like the way DeRocher dressed and used vast amounts of aftershave lotion and talked about his conquests with women and all that. Whereas Robinson was much more sort of a traditional guy who went home to his wife and kids at night and didn't. They were just totally different people. One guy was Mr. Broadway. One guy was Mr. Go Home at Night in the Suburbs and get a good night's sleep. So that intensified. The other problem that DeRocher had, he could not stand anybody who was more beloved and more admired than he was. Mm-hmm. And the time he doesn't do it, because he hates Ruth, hates Cobb, bedevils Cobb. You know, when he first comes up in 20, when he really comes up in 28, and he's with the Yankees, and it goes all the way through his life. Immediately he lands in Chicago with the Cubs, and who does he pick on but Ernie Banks, who is just can't get over this. He doesn't. Banks actually goes home and says to his mother, he says, "Why is this man hate me so much? Why does he treat me like this?" And his mother finally says to him, he said, "Look, you just have to put up with it." And he does. He does. He lives through it. And it's not until an old-timers game years afterwards that Banks comes up to DeRocher and says, "Hey, we're old guys. Where do we go right now? Let's play game. Let's play another game." He repeated that. Let's play two things. But it was part of his one guy who was starting to review the book called me up and he says, "Why don't you say in your book that he had an inferiority complex and he had this and he had that? Why did you diagnose this behavior, this sort of antagonism he had for a lot of people?" And I said, "Look, I'm a journalist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'll let the reader figure that out."
Now, you also write about another person who's considered a maverick by many. In fact, you use the word in the title, Bill Veeck, baseball's greatest maverick, which received numerous awards. Is there something about this personality you find especially attractive?
But both guys I found very attractive. I mean, they were both, to me, the interesting thing, they were both involved in racial integration. I mean, Veeck was very, very early in racial integration. DeRocher first goes after racial integration. 1939, he tells a reporter from the Daily Worker that he was being restrained from bringing in black players from Cuba, black Cubans, from playing. DeRocher is racial equality. His belief in racial equality comes from the fact that the guy that pushes him into baseball in the first place is a guy who's working in a factory with the man's name is David Redd, R-E-D-D. David Redd pushes him to go to the Hartford team and try out, and pushes him twice to go and make that team. That team then, he's there, bought from that team, the Hartford team, and goes to the Yankees. And for years and years and years, DeRocher sent World Series tickets to David Redd to make sure he got to see the World Series. So, The racial thing is amazingly, in both these guys, they're virtually colorblind, and they also see an advantage in going very early at getting the best talent among the black players, the Negro League players. And the other thing that's really interesting about DeRocher, the moment he really shows his best, where he shines like a diamond, is when he gets. When he first gets in 1949, he gets Henry Thompson and Monty Irvin, who are both African American men who have both served in the war. And Monty Irvin was in on the D-Day invasion. He was at Normandy, I think, on the third or fourth day. But when things were really bad, because there were so many, dead people had been killed. And Thompson was in the Battle of the Bulge. And I think he realizes he can't treat these guys like kids. He can't treat them like some country boy. You know, these guys have to be treated as men who have been in combat. And these are the two guys he develops and then really admires. And then along comes Mays, who has just wet behind the ears, not terribly self-confident, goes into an immediate losing streak. And I think that's the moment when DeRocher is it his most brilliant, when he can really tutor these guys, or not tutor them, but accept them and not use his sort of, sometimes he made players so mad at him that they played better. These guys, he played better because he respected them.
So without giving too much away, because obviously we want people to read the book, what is your, what do you want them to take away from this?
I just wanted to, just a very, both books, I think both Vack and this book, that it was a very colorful era with very colorful people. And they were not corporate people. They were wild and crazy, you know, people who changed the world of the world itself and baseball. And for, Durocher was the first real star who went on and did TV and did this, was in the movies and, you know, and I think what you take away is he also changed the game immeasurably. I mean, the rule in baseball that you can't argue balls and strikes, it was basically put in place because Durocher was arguing balls and strikes to the point he was getting suspended, and they finally put that rule into place. So I guess it's just seeing baseball through the perspective of New York. I mean, he really played in three places. He was really, his centers of his life were New York City, you know, mostly Broadway, because he was that kind of guy, Runyon-esque, Chicago, and Hollywood. Those were the three worlds in which he had a major impact. And I think baseball history is the history of our country. So the fact that both Vack and Durocher had to deal with the draft in World War II, had to deal with the war itself, had to deal with the losing players during the war, had to, you know, what they did after the war was instrumental. They both, you know, had their differences with Landis. I think that's why I picked both the guys, you know, because of that period and integration being a major piece in both of their stories.
And we have been speaking with Paul Dixon, author of numerous wonderful baseball books, including most recently Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. Paul, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ron.
And that was our bookshelf conversation with Paul Dixon. Tune in again soon. I wish I'd say exactly when we'll have another interesting conversation with another member of the baseball pop culture world. In the meantime, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com regularly for the latest news on baseball books, including our weekly feature on baseball bestsellers as produced by Amazon.com. And bear in mind, these are only print edition books, and that's because I'm old school. A little bit of shameless self-promotion. I have a new book coming out at the end of April. It's called Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. I do hope you'll pick that up at some point along your baseball reading journeys. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and tune in again soon. So long, everybody.